Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the managing director of Atom Ventures and Atom CTO. And today we are going to be doing a legal masterclass with Rustam Roy from Legalistic. So hello, Rustam.
Hey, Bhairav. How's it going?
Right. So the whole point of this podcast is for us to go through a set of questions. So we've got five questions laid out that can help startups, SMEs, startup entrepreneurs, founders understand a little bit more about legals. And obviously we're not going to go massively deep into any one of these topics, but at the moment in this podcast, but we'll use this as a base that further down the line, we'll end up talking in more depth into each of the different areas that we're going into today. So quickly, before we start on this, do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself, Legalistic, your background?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm a one man band. I work with small businesses, startups and SMEs, and the USP behind my business is to deliver commercially relevant legal advice. So, you know, I don't, black letter law rarely enters my discussions with clients. It's mostly about how do we make transactions happen quickly, efficiently, and properly.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So the questions we're going to go through today are, what are the key things founders need to know, think about when they're setting up a business? What can happen if something goes wrong between founders? How can founders protect their ideas? Negotiation tips, and then obviously because we're tech, we want to talk a little bit about tech contracts. So first question, when founders get together and start a new business, what are the key things they need to think about? What do they need to make sure they have in a shareholders agreement?
I think before you even think about a shareholder agreement, which would presume that it's a company, I think there's a few questions you probably want to think about before you get there in terms of the business model itself. So, you know, why are you getting into this? What's your motivation? You know, for some, it's just making money. Others feel they can do something to disrupt a certain industry or business. Others just want independence, whatever it is. You need to be clear about your motivation. You need to have done some market research to know what your target audience is, your target market, and also funds. Every business, no matter how small, requires some money to run itself, especially at the outset when you're not likely to start with revenue. So you need to think a little bit about that funding scenario. How are you going to survive at the outset? What are your running costs in future? And really break it down, you know, and then think about where that money's coming from. If you're lucky, you'll have some of that money yourself. You may have to borrow some from either friends or family or banks or others, and you need to think about whether you're willing to do that. That's a really important consideration, which you need to do at the outset. And then, of course, if there's more than one person working together to fund, you know, to start a business, you really need to think at the outset about who's contributing what to the business in terms of assets or work or contacts, products, whatever it might be. And I think it's important to state this. Really, this is one of the key aspects, because you rarely get the opportunity to talk about this once a business is successful down the line. You're just busy doing other things, constantly running around and, you know, plugging holes here and there. That's just normal. So you do need to have this right at the outset. And you need to talk about ownership of the business together. Who owns what? And that has to be probably in some proportion to what you're contributing. And you need to talk about exit. Unfortunately, these things do happen. People decide to move on. They lose interest in the business, or they have an illness. And in the worst case scenario, they die. You do need to think about what happens in those cases. And then once you've had that sort of discussion, you can think about what type of business vehicle is best, whether it's a limited company, a partnership, and then think about written documentation to set out exactly what it is that you have decided to do. And as you mentioned, shareholder agreement, for example, in the case of a limited company, is the space to set all this out very clearly. And I would say it's really important to seek external advice, because not every person with a good business idea is also a good businessman. So you do need to speak to somebody who knows what it takes to run a business and to learn from that person. I think we're lucky nowadays. There's so much free advice, easily accessible advice to SMEs and startups, especially, that you'd be crazy almost not to think about taking advantage of that.
So you mentioned obviously roles and responsibilities, understanding what people are doing within the company. How do you actually manifest that? How does that, is that literally a list of points that I'm going to do sales lead generation?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on what type of business it is, you know, because often you have businesses which are so identified with one person only because it's that person's idea. They have all the contacts. that another person may contribute very little. And I think any business needs a few elements which are the same regardless of what the business is. You have something to sell, whether that's a product or a service. You need to generate interest in that product or service, which is, you know, marketing, business development, and you need someone to run finances, right? All of these require fairly bespoke skills. So if one person doesn't have them, you do need to allocate responsibility to someone, say, you are going to do this, and to have certain targets, specific jobs, you know, submitting accounts, dealing with accountants, for example, or doing the market research, whether on LinkedIn or elsewhere. You do have to allocate those roles, I think. Otherwise, you're just stuck spending time churning through money that you have without actually doing anything concrete.
So is it, if there's two people founding a company, should it be as simple as just 50-50? Or do you think
not necessarily. I think you really have to look into it. So, for example, if it's you and I doing a business, just for argument's sake, if you bring your tech knowledge, a platform, as well as a lot of business contacts to the table, and I provide a little bit of business, you know, legal advice at the outset, I don't think it would be fair for me to expect to own 50% of the business, you know. So I think you need to have that open discussion with the people you're founding the business with, and each person has to be able to have those discussions. You have to separate, I think, your business relationship with any friendship you may or may not have in that scenario, and have very clear discussions saying, I'm contributing X, Y, Z, therefore I think I would need to own this much, you know. On the other hand, somebody might say, you know what, even though I'm bringing more to the table, I really need this person's presence and sensible advice as I go on. So I'm quite willing to give that person more than they're actually contributing at the outset. But fundamentally, everyone's got to be happy with it. That's what's key. So, you know, you and I might look at something and say, oh, that's really unfair, that's nuts. But if it works for those people and that business, then that's fine.
So, obviously, you know, I forgot what I was going to say there. Hang on. Just skip my mind. Hang on. So, when people are, obviously 50-50, it may not be the right for most companies, but should founders be giving away a lot of equity up front? So as you mentioned, you might have advisors coming in, and you might feel that, okay, this guy's great at marketing. Let me give him 5%. Let me give a CTO 5%. Let me give someone else 5%. Does that actually make sense? In my opinion, it doesn't. But
no, I think you have to be quite careful. Unfortunately, like, you know, anywhere else, there are lots of fly-by-nighters out there who will say, I'll do this and that in return for X percent equity. And, you know, and some might actually be good at what they do, but I think they need to prove their worth before you give them equity. Now, there is, of course, a problem here where, and this goes back to the funds, because if you haven't thought about where funds come from to pay for external advice, then equity might be the only currency you have. But equally, you don't have to give it to them straight away. It can be an, you know, sort of get equity as you earn type thing. It could be consideration for services rendered, and you grant certain tranches of equity on the basis of actual performance. You know, so for example, for actual business delivered, not just leads, but actual business, you know, right. People who sign a long-term contract, things like that. Or somebody who signs a long-term contract to provide legal or accountancy services on the basis of a small portion of equity. That's okay, I think, if you trust that person. But there's a judgment call there. Fundamentally, often in these sort of business decisions, it doesn't come down to whether it's right or not, but whether you've done the research, you've thought about it, are you happy with the bargain at that time, having taken everything into consideration? That's as much as you can do, you know. And you might still make a mistake, but at least looking back, you can then say, well, at least I looked at everything. I thought about everything. I didn't rush into it. But okay. Equity is what you have as your business. If you're a private limited company, that's your business, and your business might end up owning IPR and other assets. So be very careful just giving away equity, because you're giving away potentially more value than you're getting if your business is successful.
Mm. All right. So then moving on to the next question. What happens if things go wrong? So let's say, for example, you know, you and I founded a business, and then you're giving legal advice, and then suddenly you disappear and decide, actually, I'm going to sit on a beach now and not worry about the company. So how do founders deal with these scenarios? What should they be doing if they see something is not quite going the way that they planned?
That happens all the time. It's human. It's human nature, isn't it? You talk about things like any friendship, also sometimes things go wrong. And my advice always is to address it quickly and to not let it fester, because often I've seen people will sit on it. They don't want to offend the other person because they may be friends or because they still have to work closely together. But you cannot get into business with someone with whom you cannot discuss problems openly. That should be your rule. If you can't discuss possibly contentious issues with the other person or persons, you shouldn't be in business with them, because there will always be unexpected problems. People will make mistakes, and you have to be able to raise them. Now, the key thing is to raise them in a non-confrontational manner, unless, of course, in your scenario where, you know, I got off to the beach and I'm sitting there, I think you'd be entitled to be somewhat confrontational. But if it's a case of your normal business problems where somebody might have forgotten to file something, or they may have forgotten to look into whether a product or service actually is deliverable before signing up to a deal, things like that. If you want to discuss that with your founders, then you've got to be able to, in a sense, have proof of what you're saying. So be able to substantiate your view, and that's as much as you can do. And if you've done your job right in terms of setting up the business to begin with, then hopefully the written documentation will help you. You know, a shareholder agreement or a partnership agreement or even an informal memorandum between the founders to set out what you each will do. That should be able to help you.
Okay. So moving on to the next question. A lot of, obviously, we're dealing with a lot of tech businesses, and a lot of founders come to us asking for us to sign NDAs and feel that they have this business idea that they want to protect. And then as they go along, they're trying to develop IP. You know, what can founders really do to protect their ideas initially? And
yeah, that's a very, very good question. I mean, the problem founders have, leaving aside what you can do, the real problem, which doesn't go away, is that as a small startup, you will always be in an unequal bargaining position. And all the documentation in the world will not help you if you don't have the funds or the will or the time to follow it through. That's the first thing to understand, that you will almost always be in a position where the other party is more powerful. That said, you should always use NDAs, always, when discussing business, where potentially you're disclosing pricing models or your cost model or some product dev features, product map, all of that. You need to use NDAs. And during discussions, you need to reinforce that message that this is confidential. Please don't use it for anything other than the purpose of this discussion. With virtual meetings nowadays, you have the ability to tape things quite easily. I should stress as a lawyer that this should only be done with the other people's permission. You should not be recording without anyone's permission. That's absolutely key. But that's important. You can do it. It's an easy thing. So going on to IPRs next, intellectual property rights. A very important message here is one that many businesses don't know at the outset. And, you know, it's fair enough. Why would you, unless you're an IPR lawyer? It's that IPR does not protect an idea by itself. So I could have the most brilliant idea in the world about a new type of legal service, for example, but it doesn't stop anyone else from coming up with the same idea. I can't stop anyone else from having that same idea. What I can do, perhaps, is protect the expression of my idea. So how do I deliver that idea? You know, through what kind of, is it a subscription-only service, for example, or is it some clever template, some clever tech? I can protect those things by way of possibly copyright or possibly even patents, or, you know, I can trademark the name of my business, and if I trade with it correctly, if I've set up the name correctly, if I've done my research, I might possibly have some trademark rights in my business as well. But all of this requires planning, and protecting IPRs is never cheap. So this needs to be done as a step-by-step thing. You need to start with treating your IPR as valuable asset, not to just be given away. So that, you know, confidentiality, NDAs, non-competes and all of that. And then you need to have time, independent time and date stamps, for example, on collateral you generate, which contains your IPR, so that if ever anybody says, oh, I had that particular expression, I thought of it before you did, you have independent proof that actually, I've got an independent date stamp, which is a year before yours, and therefore I can't possibly have copied that from you. Little practical steps.
So looping a little bit back to the NDA, a lot of the investors nowadays will not sign NDAs, right? And there's a whole debate about this that's been raging for many, many years now, because I think the theory goes that, it is a legal overhead. It means that lawyers have to get involved. So it takes some time for them to go through that process. Another one is that it doesn't give them the freedom then to talk to others in order to help raise investment and things like that. What do you say to that? And it is a big debate that has been going
on. That's interesting. Them. I would say both of them are wrong because, if you have absolutely no idea about NDAs and confidentiality agreement, you might want to get a lawyer involved. But actually, I've seen myself, there is so much either free or very low cost and good quality advice around NDAs out there online. If you spend a little bit searching, you'll find it. NDAs are now such standard documents that really there is very little magic involved in them. Now, I'll have to caveat that by saying it can get complicated. So, for example, if you have an NDA where multiple parties are involved in a project, it can get complicated in terms of the rights you give to each party to discuss the confidential matter with their advisors. And that quickly expands into a fairly large group of people who might need to know about this. So, yes, it can get complicated. But for pure investment reasons, for a startup, I would say no. And in terms of, as in, know that, I don't put much truck in that argument at all. And in terms of being able to disclose it to others, again, I think that's a bit of a red herring because every NDA will give the other party, each party, the right to disclose it to their professional advisors. So that's a non-issue as far as I'm concerned, because you can set out in each NDA very specific purposes for which you are disclosing this and give the other side the right to discuss it, as long as they tell you who they're discussing it with.
Right. So one thing I wanted to quickly touch on, we won't go into this into too much detail because there could be a whole podcast on it, but it's around patents, trademarks, copyrights.
Yeah.
Typically, process-wise, how long do these things take to actually get?
How long is a piece of string is the answer to that, unfortunately. It can take a long time. It really is. It's not easy because, first of all, with trademarks, for example, we have registered and unregistered trademark rights in the UK. And unregistered trademark rights arise out of the use of a name that has goodwill in it. That's simple as that. So, for example, Atom Ventures, you may not have registered as a trademark, but you will certainly have some unregistered trademark rights in it. The difference between registered and unregistered is that a registered trademark is much easier to enforce against another person. That's all. It doesn't mean that unregistered trademarks have no rights, but it's a question of have you used that name in the course of trade? Is there any other party with a similar name? Because often, surprisingly, this surprises a lot of people, but you do have instances where businesses use very similar names in similar industries for a long time without being aware of it, of each other. And then suddenly, perhaps in the course of getting some investment, because one business is very successful, suddenly you have external advisors taking a closer look at the underlying rights and they figure, oh my God, there's another company with the same name. It's doing similar things for the last 5 years. And that's when things start getting interesting or not. And with patents, it really depends what you're patenting. Software is very difficult in the UK and the EU, unlike the US. Any kind of patent requires an inventive step. It's a costly process. I think you're best to budget no less than 6 months for a very easy registration without any hiccups.
Right. So these are obviously not magic bullets for any company.
Oh, absolutely not. No, absolutely not.
All right. So we talked about investors just now. Let's talk about negotiating with investors. And we also talked about friends and family rounds. So, when people are actually trying to raise the investment for the first time, as you mentioned, whether it's bank, whether it's VC, private equity, or even friends and family, what kind of things should they be having in the back of their mind when they're negotiating?
I think you need to put yourself in the position of somebody who wants money from you. What would you like to know, right? It's an investment. So clearly, anybody giving you money, unless it's your mom and dad, perhaps, but anybody else, they'll want a return, right? Mm-hmm. At the very least, they'll want their money back, even if they don't want a profit. So you have to sell it to that party saying, I want your money because I think I can do X, Y, Z with it and give you this much money back in this much time. And the way you substantiate that is by saying, well, this is my business idea. This is the target market. This is why I think I'll be able to hit X percent off that target market. And these are my operating costs. So I should be able to give you this much money, liberate this much money from my income to pay you back over this amount of time. It is all numbers, really. And there's no guarantees. And as anybody who's ever invested in anything knows, there are no guarantees of return. And you need to make that very clear, I think, that I think I'll be able to get it back to you in this time. I can't guarantee it. And these are the reasons I may not succeed. The more details you have like that, the more likely it is that somebody will actually consider your worthwhile investment, because at the very least, they will see that you've taken the time to think about all the problems you might have, all the blocks, all the good things and bad things, because no business is ever guaranteed return.
Yeah. Okay. And so the last question, which is one that touches both of our businesses, is around tech contracts, right? And we both, you know, you and I have dealt together on a number of different technology contracts where people, third parties, are delivering services, tech services to startups and to SMEs. So from your point of view, what are the key things that everyone should make sure that they have within a contract, within a tech contract for services or delivery?
Yeah, I think, as you say, I mean, there's a pretty wide variety of tech contracts, but I think in my experience, what they all have in common is that they deal with the ownership of either physical assets or IPR and the rights of use of those assets or IPR. And these are the two bits that have to be covered very clearly. So you have to really think about what assets or IPR are you allowing another party to use and for what purpose, exactly for what purpose. The temptation often is that the other party will want more use rights than they actually need. And you need to really investigate why do you need X, Y, Z rights. And you also need to think about derivative IPR, for example. What happens if we work together and using the IPR that one party contributes, we think of something completely new but related? What happens to that? It's quite frequent, actually. It's not that rare. You need to have thought about what happens in those cases, who owns what, and set that out in the contract. You really have to ask all those questions before you go signing in, especially if you're a startup and your IPR is still fairly new in the market, for example, and you haven't perhaps thought yourself about all the various users it might have.
Yeah, I think what's interesting there is that you see a number of contracts where the developers do not hand over IPR. They keep all the IP in the business themselves, and it's not even a license. I mean, well, it's licensed out, but it's licensed at quite an extortionate cost, or that IP doesn't deliver, doesn't transfer for quite some time. And I think that's one of the key issues that I see.
I think it can be quite dodgy, in my opinion. You know, I've worked on both sides of the table. Obviously, when I'm working for a customer and they're working with a software developer, for example, I'm very keen for the customer to own the IPR outright. And if the developer has a problem with getting payment, well, there's other ways to get it. But title to IPR should never, in my opinion, be withheld for purely to enforce payment, unless you've had problems with a customer in the past. Then I think it's perfectly legit. But if you haven't, then that can create a gap in title. And from a customer's point of view, these sort of things can quickly rack up into problems down the line with investors and then selling the business. Yeah. What you don't want ever is a gap in title of IPR that you think you own. So you need to investigate always, you know, why does someone want to withhold IPR, or what exactly is the cost due to? Is the cost for the IPR, or is the cost for services that are needed to make sense of the IPR and to work with it?
Right. So one of the other key things that you see often in projects, obviously not with Atom CTO or Atom Ventures, but is non-delivery, right? So is companies that deliver late, don't deliver, deliver substandard products. So what can a startup do legally in those situations?
You mean a startup which is hiring somebody else to develop for it? Yeah. It's a difficult one because it's a permanent problem in the software industry. And you know, most of my practice is working with suppliers. So I am very sympathetic to suppliers because often you find customers, especially startup customers, want everything and haven't thought about a budget or haven't thought about resources. Because, you know, any developer, as you know, if you develop for a customer, you need that customer to be engaged. Sure. You need that customer to actually know why they want something, a particular feature, functionality, you know, how are they going to use it. And very often startups simply don't have the time to have thought about all that before they tell someone they want it. And that can, you know, you can quickly rack up problems. And then there is that whole agile development, which sounds really good and is brilliant when it works, but often doesn't, because the customer will have underestimated the amount of resources required to make it work. So you have to be entering that with open eyes. And at the end of the day, from a customer's point of view, if you have thought about that, then I think you need to think very clearly about fixed price development gigs, because if that's your budget, that's your budget. And you need to make that very clear and say, well, this is the total cost I'm willing to pay you, and I'll structure in such a way that my payment to you is dependent on you delivering certain things on time. And you can even flip that and say, well, actually, this is my budget. Say it's 500,000, just for argument's sake, which is a huge budget, I know. But, yeah. You know, it's not realistic at all. So, but say your budget's 500 grand, and you can say, well, I'm willing to pay you 500 if you deliver everything on time and it works. But if you don't, then for every, say, month of a delay before it goes live, the price I pay you goes down by X amount. So you need to think about just clever ways to adjust the price you pay, which is ultimately the only tool you have as a customer, for things you actually get. And then you have to, governance is key. You have to engage with your supplier constantly and make sure that you're aware of where they're at, what the problems are, if any, and how, what you can do to help make it work. But I think you'd be, as a customer, you'd be naive to think that even the most professional and earnest, honest supplier, they will have delays. That's just the nature of the beast. And you need to take that into consideration for any deadlines you might have. That even with the best will in the world, you might encounter unexpected problems, which will lead to a little bit of delay here and there. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, software is developed by humans, right? And humans have issues that they have to deal with. I think one of the things that we find, and we try to stress to, well, we do stress to startups and SME business owners, is that they need to have everything work very well thought out before they start development. So that's why we create a project brief. And I think a lot of them don't see the value in it. And that's because they've never done the projects before, but obviously we've got many, many years of experience in doing it. And all of the projects where we have a brief, which is well thought out, tend to all run on time and get delivered, right?
Minimal problems. Front loading that is the best thing a customer can do. As a startup, if you want someone to develop something for you, you have to spend that time at the outset in planning. You have to, before you anyone starts developing anything. If nothing else, it's an opportunity to discuss why you want something and whether it really is what you think it might be. You know, a good developer will also be able to challenge some of your assumptions and ideas and say, well, do you really want this, or do you really want that, or this could be done better this way, you know, like you guys do. Mm-hmm. So, spend the time at the outset. I absolutely agree.
All right, Rustam, thanks for that. Hopefully this has been useful to the startup founders and small business owners out there.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, yeah, you can talk about these things endlessly, but you've got to start somewhere.
And how do people get in touch with you if they want to learn more from you?
I've got a website, legalistic.co.uk. My email is on there, so have a look and get in touch. I certainly like to hear from people with business ideas. I love it. I don't charge for talking to people because I learn stuff as well.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks, Bharav.